Our next presentation is actually a panel, also from UCLA. Anthony Seeger, who is the director of the UCLA Ethnomusicology Archive, Maureen Russell, who is an archivist and cataloger, and David Martinelli, who is our audio technician. And they're going to give a discussion in turn, and then open it up for questions and broader discussions about ethnographic archives in universities, because I think it's sort of a niche area, especially as far as ARSC is concerned. A lot of people deal with historical and commercial collections, but the UCLA Ethnomusicology Archive is one of the largest ethnographic sound collections, and we deal with all the same issues of preservation and access and metadata that other collections do, but also some special issues because of the type of material that we have. And so I think we're starting with Tony.
Yes, but first the PowerPoint.
But first the PowerPoint.
You were going to start.
Yes.
Or do you want me to start it?
No, I will start the PowerPoint. If it will. Yes.
Can you do slideshow? Yeah.
How do I advance it?
Just the spacebar.
Spacebar.
Well, good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. Nice to see you. Welcome to Los Angeles, and welcome to our very brief presentation about the UCLA Ethnomusicology Archive. Peggy gave a brilliant presentation about the special collections, and you wonder, well, why isn't ethnomusicology part of a special collection? In fact, that's precisely one of the questions we're going to answer. Ethnomusicology archives specialize in unique recordings of music from many parts of the world. We also often collect other sorts of recordings, commercial recordings from many parts of the world, but our vision is global, always has been, and our intention is very much focused on preserving the results of research and also making available those results to future researchers. About 51 years ago, a young ethnomusicologist started a program, Institute for Ethnomusicology at UCLA, and the next year he started the Ethnomusicology Archive as part of that Ethnomusicology Institute. And he did that because the whole field of ethnomusicology really only began when audio recordings could be made. It's one of the fields that's often traced to the beginning of recorded sound, because recordings of sound made it possible to collect recordings in one place and analyze them comparatively and systematically. And that happened especially in the Berlin Phonogram Archive and was done by Erich von Hornbostel, who collected, disseminated, and trained a lot of people in analysis and also further collecting and further archive creation. Franz Boas, the anthropologist at Columbia, asked Erich von Hornbostel to send one of his assistants over to start an archive and the study of ethnomusicology in the United States, and he did. George Herzog started his own archive, first at Columbia, and then he took part of it to Indiana University. And so what you had was a movement of, if you're going to create a place to study music of the world, you have to create an archive, and that archive then becomes the heart of the study of the music of the world. That's where the researchers are, that's where the resources are, and the sound is very much a part of it. And so there's the Berlin Phonogram Archive as it looks today. There's Erich von Hornbostel. But what has happened in the United States is, after UCLA started, and UCLA was the first program in ethnomusicology, after it started, then other programs in ethnomusicology also similarly started, small university-based archives specializing in unique recordings. And those were done at Columbia, as I said, at Indiana, at Harvard, Wesleyan, UCLA, University of Washington, University of Illinois, and other places. And we're one of those, I think, as we're one of the larger ones, because we've been around for a while, and also because we very systematically try to collect important resources for research. I think that was what I wanted to say, was that this archives that you're going to see is what it is, partly because of the history of the field at which it is, to a certain extent, the center, and continues to be active to this day. Thank you. Maureen Russell, I think, is next. And then David Martinelli, who is our technician, will talk about the more technical parts of reproduction and preservation.
Since you know I have lots of pictures, Tony, if you have comments you want to make, please do.
I saw one of those pictures. I'm not dead.
You know what I mean. So the UCLA Ethnomusicology Archive, I'm very picture happy. For us, the issue is it's not simply audiovisual, but there are field recordings. It's unique ethnographic-based sound and picture. Oops. I think I backed up. Wait, this is a really touchy keyboard, isn't it, Aaron?
Yes. Try the mouse.
Okay.
If you click the mouse, maybe it'll...
There we go. I'll try the mouse. It'll make me happier. Is ethnographic-based sound and picture. That happens to be a photo of Mantlehood in Ghana. An ethnographic field collection is basically a group of unpublished materials that has been gathered by a cultural researcher. It could be an anthropologist like Professor Seeger, an ethnomusicologist, folklorist, and basically it's going to bring together a whole range of materials and formats. Sound recordings, video recordings, photographs, you'll see photos. This is one of my personal favorite pictures of Professor Seeger. if you can see this, he's being clubbed to death by the Suya women, I believe. Yes. I don't know what he did. You'll have to ask him.
I'll never tell.
In any case, so we're talking about what a field worker is. For an ethnographic archive, that tends to be how we organize collections, by the collector or the field worker. And the field worker makes a sound recording, a photograph, a moving image, interviews people. Basically, they try to create a performance or create a representation of a performance by sound, picture, and the written word. Gotta be careful about that. Even if there is no intent to publish this documentation, it's a very deliberate combining of representational media, so it's something that looks like authorship. Again, that's Mantlehood. The collections can be from any part of the world. The United States, this folklorist D.K. Wilgus recording Son House at one of the UCLA folk festivals. Klezmarola, this is pianolista Bob Berkman. He specializes in ethnic piano roles. And I have to get in a brief non-commercial plug for anyone who is in town on May the 23rd. I heard Tony mentioning this. We are actually having a pianola concert at UCLA in honor of our 50th anniversary. And it's, as you can see, Finnish, Jewish, Russian, Hungarian. It's a wide range of world music. So we hope some of you can attend. Back to our regularly scheduled broadcast, Peru, and in all of these pictures, the ethnomusicologist is in the picture. So that's Jonathan with the camera. Brazil, China, that's Helen Reese playing the flute. And even Pandora, yes, it's true. James Horner hired an ethnomusicologist to create the instruments for Pandora. Do the collections arrive neatly organized, preserved, and nicely boxed? Thank you from the room, people who've dealt with it. How an archivist first sees a collection. And I'm sure Peggy's got pictures like this too. It's very typical, garages, basements, attics. This happens to be the Edward Levesque collection. For any film buffs, he was one of the original Keystone Cops. And he was also a Spanish language DJ in LA in the 40s and 50s. These are actually all commercial recordings, and they're all Spanish language materials. So they're all 45s from mainly LA-based record labels who recorded Spanish language music. There's a few Mexican labels, but most of them are Southern California labels. And it was his grandchildren and children who gave us the collection. Again, an ethnographic collection can include a wide variety of formats and objects. So this is a gramophone postcard from Bosnia from 1914. And according to Tim Rice, who is our expert in the area, this is actually the earliest representation he had seen of a gramophone in that particular area. So piano rolls. And I don't know if Tony wants to comment on this. We have a huge photo collection, primarily documenting the history of the now department, then Institute of Ethnomusicology. And this is Charles Seeger at the Mellograph.
He's trying to go the other way, to make a graph from south.
There you go. We had to get in a picture of Mantle Hood, who was the young scholar that Tony mentioned, who founded the Institute of Ethnomusicology, and he was one of the leading figures in the research on Javanese gamelan. So this is him playing the gamelan. We have commercial as well as field recordings, and this is one of the early commercial releases from the Institute of Ethnomusicology, and the Venerable Dark Cloud, which is our Javanese gamelan. We have films. Okay, we don't really keep them this way. They're in pretty archival boxes now. These are really just the boxes. Instruments. We try very hard not to take instruments because we don't really have expertise in handling them, but when we got the Don Ellis collection, that was part of the family's request that we take everything. So this is his Superbone, which is a combination slide valve trombone. And yes, even costumes. Was it Peggy who just got costumes? And this looks much more impressive in person because it has mirrors sewn all over it. But it was a costume worn by Ellis on a Shirley MacLaine television special in the, not surprisingly, 70s. So describing collections. So now that we have all this stuff, what do we do with it? Okay, this is the wordy stuff. Basically, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to triage it. For us, again, the collector is important. So we're going to figure out the collector, the geographic area, the culture, ethnic group, the date range, the format types, if it's got any immediate preservation needs, what supplies do we need, how long do we think it will take to process, and then how we think we're going to organize it. And I'm a speed talker, so. Series structure is something that you will often hear archivists mention, and all it really means is how do you want to intellectually organize or arrange materials in a collection. It's really typical to organize materials by format. So these are really broad headings. You know, you could audiovisual, photographic, correspondence. For us, almost everything is that top category. So since we are an audiovisual archive, so we tend to, you know, our tape reels are separate from our cassettes, which are separate from our wires, et cetera. So basically, we need to turn this, and that's the picture of a real collection, into this. One of our students, Iris, said this is her favorite part of working in an archive, is creating those pretty gray boxes. So now again, now that we have all this stuff, what do we do with it? You need to describe it, and you need to describe it so people can find it. So there are any number of levels of description that could be appropriate for archival materials. What we normally start with is something that's called collection level cataloging. I know there's catalogers in the room, but which basically involves cataloging related items as a whole in a single bibliographic record. Okay, this is the geeky stuff. So since I'm the cataloger, basically you're going to create what's called a supply title. It's something that you hope is descriptively rich in an ethnographic-based collection. Usually the supply title starts with a geographic area, we'll mention a culture group, possibly a genre, date range, and again the collector. And we catalog ethnographic collections like this. Indiana does, Library of Congress does. It's a pretty standard way to deal with ethnographic collections. A cataloger will also add standardized subject, genre, and name headings, because again, the important part of this for us is intellectual access. People have to be able to find it. And Aaron said I should get in a plug for the fact that we use MARC as our structural standard and AACR2 as our content standard. Okay, and this is just an example. Everyone runs screaming from the room. This is the Jacqueline JJ collection. And for the librarians maybe in the room, one of the things that's interesting about the way an archive tends to handle a collection in terms of the catalog is that we basically use it as an inventory as well. So if you look at this, you see not only the intellectual access, the descriptive part of what's in the collection, but also all of our formats. So we have original master reels, but then we've made preservation master compact discs, and we also have access copies. So that's, in all honesty, is for us as much as for the user. Okay, and then item level description. So again, we start with that very broad collection level. We're going to go to item level. Finding aid or collection guide, I'm sure collectors in the room create their own. It can be almost anything. Basically, it's just consolidating information about a collection. For our online finding aids at UCLA, we use DACS, which is Describing Archival Collections, and EAD, which is Encoded Archival Description. Yes, I'm almost done, I'm a cranker. So we have paper finding aids on a shelf. That's just what a finding aid looks like in the archive. Again, many levels of description can be required for a single collection. Again, from that collection level record to metadata about a single digital object. This is an online finding aid. This happens to be for the Don Borchert collection, which is a collection of rural music from Mexico that was recorded in the 60s. It's one of our most important collections. Again, I'll have a biography, scope notes, subjects. And this is another layer of description. This is a description of the first two tapes from the box. And then if a collection is digitized, you also need descriptive metadata for the digital object. Lots and lots and lots of description. And Peggy mentioned this. One of the things that we are very lucky is that at UCLA, we can, even though we are not part of the library, we can use the California Digital Library. And part of that is the Online Archive of California. That's something Peggy mentioned. And the nice thing for us is it basically can provide all that technical infrastructure so that we don't have to. That's the URL if you'd like to look at it. It has over 150 contributing institutions with over 20,000 finding aids and 170,000 digital objects. And it's growing every day. And now to David.
Okay, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about digitizing field recordings and some of the issues that you get on field recordings that you may not necessarily encounter with other types of recordings. Field recordings were usually done under all kinds of circumstances by all kinds of people, either very skilled people or people not skilled at all, people with high-end, top-of-the-line equipment, or people with just, you know, the cheapest kind of stuff they could get. What they all have in common is they're not done under what you would call a professional recording situation. It's not done in a studio. It's done out in a field somewhere. It's done in somebody's house. It's done in the middle of the countryside. So a lot of times when you're recording tapes, you rely on things like test tones, for example, to gauge the recording level. Well, I never get anything with test tones. Or if there are test tones there, they're all over the place, so they don't make any sense. So the first thing I go to when I get a tape is I look at the documentation. And sometimes the documentation is very detailed, tells you everything you need to know, and it's accurate, everything is correct, the tape speed, the format of the tape, where it was recorded, who's on the tape, and all of the contents of the tape, they're all indicated. So sometimes that's what I get. Other times you get some of that information and not all of it. Sometimes there's songs that are listed that are not on the tape, or vice versa. Sometimes you get just very general information, like 7.5 IPS half track, or you get the names of the performers. Sometimes there's no information at all. So I've had to digitize tapes that are a blank, unlabeled reel, or an unlabeled cassette, and an unlabeled box. And okay, well, That's what you have. And then sometimes there's documentation, but it's in a language that you don't understand. So field recordings, you know, they come from all over the world. And I know English and bits and pieces of other languages, but not all of them. So the actual tapes themselves, they're recorded under a variety of conditions. Most of the tapes are, I'm talking about reel-to-reel tapes, they're recorded at 7.5 or 3.75 IPS, which is pretty standard, and that's the bulk of what I deal with. There's a few that are recorded at 1.78 IPS, and then very rarely I will encounter something either recorded at 15 IPS, which is like a more professional type of speed, or at the other extreme, 15/16 IPS. That's very slow. That's slower than a cassette. Sometimes tapes will start at one speed and change as you progress through the tape. The obvious reason is somebody's out recording something and they don't have a supply of tapes there, so they had to slow down the tape because their tape is running out, but they want to capture everything, so they slow down the tape. So it starts at 7.5 and then it goes to 3.75, gets down to 1.78. But fortunately, we have at the archive something that can deal with this. This machine here, which was there when I started working there. This has saved us on many occasions. As you can see on this is the Sony tape recorder, TC-800B. As you can see on the right-hand side, you've got 7.5, 3 3/4, 1 7/8, and 15/16. So this is a lifesaver. The one drawback of this machine is the output is it's a mini jack. It's a stereo mini jack. So my Atari deck has nice balanced outputs, but it won't play at 15/16. So
it handles reel-to-reel tape?
Yes, it does. Yes. Yes, I think this one does 5-inch only. But so if I have a tape, you know, that's at that slow speed on a 7-inch reel, I have to get creative and start doing things. Okay. Okay. So yeah, like now, so the field tapes mainly they're always quarter-inch tapes, and every quarter-inch format: half-track mono, quarter-track stereo, two-channel stereo, full-track mono. I've encountered all of those, mostly half-track mono. If we do encounter a tape that's over a quarter inch or it's a multi-track format, we really can't deal with that. We don't have any equipment to deal with that. I want to show you something. Like I was saying before that sometimes the tape speed changes in the course of a tape. Normally, that's not the case. Normally, they're very easy to figure out. There was one tape I did which was very crazy, and I was so involved that I had to write it down to keep track of what was going on with this tape. So this is a diagram. So the top line is the one channel. The bottom line is the other channel. It's mainly half-track mono. You can see that the first channel starts off with some bits of 7.5 mono, switches to 3 3/4 mono. I'm talking about the right-hand side of the top track. And then we get a bit of 3 3/4 inch stereo with a little cut-in in the middle of 3 3/4 inch mono and then some blank tape at the end. The other channel going the opposite way is 3 3/4 inch mono, and then you get the second channel of the stereo signal with a little cut-in in the middle, though, going the other direction, and then resuming 3 3/4 inch mono. That's an extreme case. Only one time have I gotten something that complicated. 2 minutes. Okay, the sound quality varies widely on these tapes. Sometimes it's very good, sometimes it's not good at all. Sometimes they indicate what equipment they used to record, but a lot of times they didn't, so you don't know what kind of equipment they used to record it on. One issue that I get is there's all kinds of signals on the tape. There's buzzes, there's hums, the speed fluctuates. I lose frequencies, and I always have to wonder, is it my equipment that's causing it, or was it on the tape like that? And usually, thank goodness, it's the tape is like that. And then the other issue is, a lot of this music is not familiar to me personally. Some of it is, some of it isn't. So if you're getting music that you're not really familiar with, and it's recorded less than optimum recording quality, kind of very murky at times, you don't really know, okay, is this going forwards or is this going backwards? Is this playing at the right speed? Is it too fast? Is it too slow? I did something the other day, it sounded like a very fast playing, but it was at the wrong speed. It was twice as fast. So no, most of the time you can catch these things. Very rarely am I just totally puzzled by it. Okay.
Thank you to Tony and Maureen and David. And we have just a couple of minutes now for questions or a little bit of discussion, particularly on some of the these issues that they've talked about with dealing with ethnographic sound recordings. So, yes.
Indiana does it. There are archives of traditional music.
Yeah, I know Indiana does it. I didn't know.
Harvard's World Music Archive does it. We do it.
Well, you see, what happens with ethnomusicology archives is things don't have titles necessarily.
No,
most folk songs, people will give you, many folk songs people will give you a title on, but, and of course, all commercial music comes with titles. So we're stuck. And the way we try to find things is, of course, through this way, which I think probably originated in a very early type of cataloging with paper catalogs. But it's been consistently applied pretty much in the ethnomusicology archives, I think.
Also, for both in cataloging and in finding aids, in most cases, our primary point of access is geographical because, at least for ethnomusicologists, that's how our users are most likely to search for materials, unless they happen to know the name of a particular collector or something. But in most cases, the users are looking for a geographical point of entry.
Geographic area or culture group.
Or culture group, yes. Other questions? Steve? Her paper, was her paper on DAX or was it on cataloging? Marcia, do you know?
Sorry.
Caitlin Hunter's paper, did she give a talk? Was it about DAX for audio collections or was it about cataloging?
It would have been about cataloging.
Okay.
We're actually, our DAX for Archival Sound Recordings Committee is meeting just before the end of this session. And we're going to have to talk about that.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that. Chris?
Does that Sony player also handle cassettes or not, just reel-to-reel?
It's only reel-to-reel.
Do you have a good cassette machine that you can recommend?
Yes. Oh, that we could recommend?
I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
They're hard to find, let me tell you. And then, yes, then you have to negotiate for quite a while to get it working right.
We've got a line on one now, but we've been searching for quite a while. So,
have I got
Yeah.
Come and talk to us.
Yeah. We have to get this wrapped up. I think Tony would like to say one more thing before we move on to the next presentation.
Yes. Archives have changed a lot in the last 50 years. And one of the things that's happened at our archive is that it used to all be in one place, and now it's in different places. We store it in an earthquake-proof storage area, and we have our permanent sort of access is going to be all online through the California Digital Collections or UCLA Collections. And yet, the archive really is a group of very dedicated people who work at it, because they are the ones that actually find the collectors, convince them to give it, and walk them through the process of negotiating rights and processes of acquisition, and also work with the lost students who can't imagine, and in fact, senior scholars sometimes who can't imagine how to find anything or look for anything, and they help them not only find it, but walk them through the process of using it. So I really would like you, as you sort of thank us for the paper, what you're really doing is applauding a very fine staff that is all actually in front of you. We're all of it. And the reason an archive works and the reason it is a place separate is this staff is really the heart of a whole process of study and preservation and also repatriation to the communities that want this, because these are unique, and bad as the quality is to the people who made that music, it's a tremendously important thing to get it back. And so this whole process that we're doing is a process that
It begins with a field recording in some place, but ends up often with that sound going back to that place and reinvigorating them, stimulating them, making them cry sometimes, making them laugh. And that is part of the reward of working in an archive. Thank you.
Thank you, David, Maureen, and Tony.